Earners, what's up? Look, in the world of personal finance management, finding the right tool is crucial. If you've been relying on Mint to keep your personal finances in check, I got a mix of news for you. Mint is closing down. But here's a silver lining. Monarch Money is stepping up as the go-to financial app, and users, including myself, are making the switch with a smile. Before Monarch, juggling my finances felt like navigating a stormy sea. Other apps either lacked features or were too cumbersome. Then came Monarch Money. Its ease of use, powerful features, and sleek design turned financial management from a chore into a breeze. The constant updates, well, that's the cherry on top. But what truly set it apart for me was its collaboration feature. Money matters can strain relationships, but Monarch brings peace to the table. The app's collaboration tools allow my partner and I to seamlessly manage our finances together. We aligned on our budgets, tracked our cash flow, and even planned our future goals all in one place. Speaking of goals, be it saving for a down payment, your dream vacation, or your children's education, Monarch simplifies it all. It's no wonder the Wall Street Journal hailed it as the best budgeting app. This isn't just an app. It's the next generation of personal finance management, ad-free, intuitive, and always evolving with you in mind. Now look, Monarch isn't just another app. It's the all-in-one solution, from effortlessly importing your data from Mint to customizing your dashboard to your heart's content. Monarch respects your privacy with a strict no ads, no data selling policy. This is financial management as it should be, focused on you. Look, after trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/Mondays. That's monarchmoney.com/Mondays for your extended 30-day free trial.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Live.
All right, guys. Welcome back.
Monday.
Happy Monday.
Yes, it is, sir.
The 15th of January. Yes. Mark is closer there.
Martin Luther King Day.
Yeah, Dr. Martin Luther King Day. Is his actual 90? Is it 95th or 90?
95. Yeah,
95th birthday will be celebrated today and recognized. So, school is out, market's closed, but you know who's here.
The yeah,
folks. That's Market Monday.
Rest in peace to Martin Luther King for sure.
Absolutely.
May his legacy live on and continue forever
to all of us.
So yeah, you know, Market Mondays, we are back.
Yes.
Oh, you mean the background? I know you. They're wondering why it changed. Well, folks,
we're in the cabin.
We are in a wood cabin.
Are you in Aspen or
not this way, right? Okay. Not the Poconos.
Gotcha. Definitely not Poconos.
The closest you Chili's been.
Yeah, we out here, man. We're gonna talk about that in a little bit, but yeah, we're in Davos for the week. So a lot to talk about, you know.
Tell the reptilians to say what up.
Applications are still pending in the middle of the Swiss Alps. Checking the vibes out here, man. It's important. We had a couple walk arounds, a couple of panels that we walked past today. It's important that we're here. And we're starting to see a little bit more of us out here to actually report what's happening and give it back to y'all in a way that makes sense, that makes it digestible, but to tell you what's ahead in the future. So like Trey said, we'll get into that. But we are here safe and we are protected.
That is all code for they sold their soul. Come on, let's also do the review video. They were so humble in
again
living room. And
all right, damn. And now they're in the wood cabin with the chandelier.
Haters fall off you dusty, you can't win.
What Benny say, hey, this thing, I signed Illuminati deal. Signed, sealed, and delivered. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been real. See you guys next year. See you guys next year.
Perhaps.
Man, a lot to talk about. We got a guest today.
Yeah.
Yes.
Welcome back, guest.
For sure.
Yes.
Yeah, we got JC. So This is something that, you know, we did last year, and he went over charts, and he was very eloquent in how he went over the charts and talked about the election and how politics play and go into recessions and all kinds of different stuff like that. So, a very intelligent guy, back for the second time.
You know what was dope about it? He kind of went against the grain, right? Like, everybody was talking recession, second half of the quarter. He pulled out them charts and showed everybody why he did not agree and what we should be looking forward to. And so if people watch that episode and they executed on it, I mean, they should be well off by at this point. Because
they should be in Davos.
I mean, to say he was on point and right is an understatement, man. He nailed it. But incredible. And we're happy to have him back. Privileged to have him back, man. It's going to be dope.
For sure. So I won't spend too much time with a big week for EYL tomorrow. We got my boy Joey Crack, Fat Joe. Our interview with Fat Joe from Art Basel. Shout out to Fat Joe. A lot of gems, a lot of funny stories per usual. So I'm sure people, he talked about his IRS problems, talked about a variety of different stuff, lessons that he learned, and entrepreneurship, losing money, getting back on his feet. So he's a very transparent person.
Someone on the right team.
Yeah, for sure.
Reconciliation.
Great conversation. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. So, check it out tomorrow, 1 o'clock, Eastern Standard Time. And we're going to have some big news on EYL University, too. We got to revamp curriculum and revamp format. So we're going to be talking about that in the coming week. So stay tuned. But we got big plans for EYL University for 2024, for sure. And anything else? I think that might be it. Ian, anything on your side?
Stock Club call will be this Wednesday. If you're watching, the Stock Club prices are out. I added 5 new companies, and I added, I think, 10 dividend companies that I like that I've never talked about before in Stock Club. So check that out. If I've made you money, please put yes in chat. And shout out to Larry Fink for taking over crypto. On one that boy's smart. Ooh, he's talking this book on every show possible. I can't wait to talk about it.
All right, let's get it.
Yeah, y'all know how this works, man. Do your own research. Our content is intended to be used and must be used for informational purposes only. It's very important that you do your own analysis before making any investment based on your own personal circumstances. You should take independent financial advice from a professional in connection with or independently research and verify any information that you find on our show and wish to rely upon, whether for the purpose of making an investment decision or otherwise. This is a message brought to you by the good brothers at Earn Your Leisure and the good brother Ian Dunlap, the master investor himself. Tupac Shakur in the flesh.
Yes. Political wave.
Let's get it.
All 24.
Let's get it. All right. So let's talk about this. Kathy Woods, who was at InvestFest this year.
Yes.
She was actually on a panel with Ian, Michael Novogratz, Ian, Kathy Woods, InvestFest alumni. So she made a bold prediction that Bitcoin bull case could possibly get to 1.5 million and base case of 600,000 for Bitcoin. And 1 million is something that I've heard $1 million for Bitcoin for a while, as far as, like, you know, ultimate goal, ultimate projection. Yeah. So how do you evaluate her analysis? Do you share her optimism? And do you think it's a little misguided? Like, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I love Kathy. Currently, we're at like almost 43,000. So to get to that base case, that's like 11x return. That is a ratio that I like when I am investing. But I don't know the pathway or time frame for how long we get there. I don't know if it'd be 10 years. Ultimately, I think it can hit 500,000. But when people were sending me this, they were like, do you think it could happen in 3 or 4 years? And I'm like, no. Most assets don't climb at 11x in a 4 year period, even though Bitcoin is like the number one return asset of all time. So I do believe in a proclamation, but it may take 20 years to get there. We're not getting there in 3 or 4 years. I love Kathy. Shout out to the team. Kudos to everybody at ARK. But is this what people feel like when I like say things are gonna fall 80%? Because I'm like 1.5. Come on,
that's
it's gonna take a while.
The original projection was a million. And I guess after the Bitcoin ETF got approved, they had it back on and it went up to 1.5. Now, this is kind of the question inside of the question. Is the analysis misguided or is the time frame misguided? Right? Because she's saying by 2030, which gives us 6 years to get to 1.5, worst case 600,000. Or do we at some point seeing, right? Because obviously at some point, all the Bitcoin that will be minted will be, there will be a time when that happens. Is there a case that we can see it at that level, just not in 6 years?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen in 6 years. Of course, we'll have a great boom after halving. I agree with that 1,000%. But yeah, I think the timing of when this will happen will be misguided. Love Bitcoin long term. But I think the projection is, that's like me saying Apple's going to go to 2,500 in 5 years. Not gonna happen. But I do give her credit. She was the first one to put Tesla and Bitcoin in the pairing in a fund to get accelerated gains. Everyone copied her after that. I agree with that 1,000%. But yeah, this time frame does not work, even with the ETFs being announced.
I mean, she's been bold in her predictions and her case points. And listening to her speak, I can see, right, based on the analysis of what she's saying in terms of the amount of supply, obviously the ETF, the rate of people holding onto it is increasing. We've seen it, I think it was similar to 2021 when Bitcoin was at 59,000. It was very similar. So the analysis, I think, is on point. I kind of agree with you here. I can't see it in 6 years. But for those people that are looking for the end of the year case, she 100,000. I'm more towards the 70,000 range to 100. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm at like 65,838. And where I think we should land. Like, in order for Bitcoin to go that high, we would have to have a contagion level event in the financial space. Banks would have to collapse. A lot of trust would have to be lost in the dollar, and then pension and mutual funds will have to have a mass exodus from dollars into Bitcoin. Now, if that happens, game, set, match. But I don't see the monetary system changing and deploying all that capital into Bitcoin. So when questions like these are posed, opposed to just saying no or yes, I think it's really important for the audience to say, what are like the five levers that would make that happen? We would need like a large scale banking crisis, and then hedge funds, mutual funds, pension funds to start to move majority of their capital into Bitcoin, and I don't see that happening right now. So
these are all bullish projections, right? There's the other end to that where there's going to be a bearish projection where we know that Bitcoin is speculative and we know that it's volatile, and we've seen crypto winters before where it's dropped 50 to 60%. And so if you put that inside of the scenario, I mean, it makes it even tougher to get to, 70,000, but forget a million.
What? Okay, now I'm going to be on the side of the crypto audience. Was there a winter, or was like the banks blowing snow and turned off the heater?
And what year?
The last year and a half. NFTs got demonized. Logan Paul got caught up in a scandal. Every celebrity got caught up in a scandal through propaganda. They demonized it. And then Larry Fink is all in the video dancing, talking about Ripple and Bitcoin. And I've never heard him speak this much while Vanguard comes out and says, hey, none of our customers can buy it. Like, there's a war going on. And remember 2 years ago, I was like, hey, the banks are going to come in, take over crypto.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're seeing it.
When I think of that, the NFT period, I'm not sure. Could qualify as a winter. When I think crypto winter, I'm thinking like 2018, right off that run at the end of 2017, when it became something that was widely known by the masses and people were investing in it blindly. And we saw it run up. And then we saw alternate coins also be a part of that mix. And then in 2018-19, we saw a drastic pullback where coin drops down from 20,000 now down to 3. That period is when I think of crypto winter, I think of that time period specifically.
Yeah. I just think it's very interesting that for what, Rashad, 40 years. They told us 7-12% was the norm that we should expect. Crypto comes, they don't want it. Crypto goes on fire, all coins go on fire. And now all of a sudden they're giving up on the traditional S&P 500, Russell 2000 strategy, and now trying to infiltrate and take over the crypto space. And they have done so successfully. So a great lesson I've learned through all of this and with Kathy, people want high returns. And whoever can do that with the lowest drawdown is ultimately going to win. But I don't see 500,000 anytime soon, but I do think we'll crack 100,000 by next year for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see. We'll monitor the situation. So
he going to talk to Satoshi Nakamoto. What's his name? Why y'all out there? I know y'all going to the panel. Don't want to say nothing, but can you ask him for us and the people who are not there?
His panel's tonight.
I saw the Ripple House. Drove past it, so I was trying to stop by there this week, which is ironic that, you know, there's a Ripple House here. Wow. Because it still is a little confusing why it's, so many people are enthusiastic about XRP when they kind of go against what crypto was originally designed for, as far as to be anti-establishment and something that was decentralized. And this is as central as you can get. We're talking about the World Economic Forum. So for Ripple to have a house in Davos.
They are about to attack you. I listen.
No, I'm just saying. I invested in Ripple early. And
yeah,
XRP. I invested in XRP early, right? Because obviously Ripple's a company that was only going to want all of these people in the comments. I invested in XRP early. But, I mean, it just is what it is, right? I'm not one of those people that I don't – because I know that nothing is decentralized. I understand that nothing is decentralized. So I'm not – you know, I'm not going out on this – look, this is the best story ever told outside of the Easter Bunny and maybe some other things that I can't say because people might get offended. But,
no,
you
don't go.
You create something from an Asian man that nobody's ever known that has a thesis to change the world. And in 20 years, it's going to be worth $1 million. This is a hell of a story, but people like stories. So we can go with it if you want. If you want to go with the story, we can go with it.
I can't wait till Dr. Umar come out and reveals that he is Satoshi.
Guys,
all them schools going to be popping up all over the world at that point. But yeah, narratives have to get built. Yeah, I like XRP a lot, but I do find it interesting. It's kind of like when DMX was coming up and then he was too rough. And then the album came out, he moved units and it's like, oh, well, let's push him now. Banks have given such low return and have such low trust. I think they don't have a choice but to partner with XRP and Bitcoin and Ethereum. You know, I've talked endlessly about the partnership with Chase and Ethereum. So I just find it very interesting. We had a very interesting point in time, and the next few years would definitely be pretty damn interesting. But I agree. 2 years ago, everybody was killing me about these platforms and assets being decentralized, and now they're in the big castles that run the world.
It's not decentralized. Like, you know, every bank owns it. It's traded on the stock market. It's as central as the IMF.
If you know, you know.
If you know, you know. All right. Microsoft has surpassed Apple as the world's largest company by market cap. So the great thing is that we posted that like a week ago, that Microsoft was only $100 billion away from passing Apple in market cap. And at that time, you know, there's a lot of people in the comments that was like, laugh out loud, only $100 billion. Like, yeah. But you know, it's a teachable moment as far as for corporate finance and, you know, how things that can look like a large number to some is a very small number to somebody else. Yeah. Perception is everything. And that's the thing about life. One person's mountain is another person's hill, right? One person's trash is another man's treasure. Mm-hmm. We could go down a line here. So,
no pun intended.
Perception is a very important perception is a very important thing. So, $100 billion, yeah, to the average person, to me, like, as I'm looking at it from a bank account standpoint, if I was looking at it from that standpoint, then yeah, I'd be like, oh yeah, $100 billion, that's crazy. But I think it's an important part of the job is to educate people. So we wasn't talking about it as far as like in somebody's net worth.
Yeah, just in our Bank of America.
Tomorrow I'll have 100 million.
So it's a teachable moment. But so Microsoft has surpassed Apple that quickly. $100 billion, they caught up that quickly. So do you foresee Microsoft maintaining this lead? And how does this play out for the future of both companies? Do you see Apple reclaiming the position? Does it matter? Is it like just a celebratory thing that, you know, it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things, or is it actually important?
I think it's actually important. Anytime you lose pole position and you're not number one, you have to start to be worried. Some stats around Microsoft. Profit margin, this is a multi-trillion dollar company, 34% profit margin. Whew. Amazing. Operating margin, 43%. Gross margin, 68%. Return on assets, 19%. Institutional ownership, 72%. So at a time when Apple is not the innovator, the leader in breaking edge technology, once you, and we have to compare this to, Apple is also a consumer-based company that does some enterprise and some B2G. Microsoft does a ton of B2G, ton of enterprise with wider margins. You have to be worried when someone passes you up. This isn't just like some milestone that does not matter. And normally when these companies are number one, and of course, for the next year or two, I think they'll go back and forth in terms of market cap. But once again, if they don't innovate, I can see Microsoft keeping that lead. And with the interest in AI, and it's the interesting part, Microsoft hasn't partnered with anybody to make an electronic vehicle, which we can talk about that space later. They have not gotten into healthcare, and they don't have a consumer product that people love. If they actually innovate and make a product that people really love at scale, with the leadership, with Satya just being focused on the business, this could be the era where Microsoft remains dominant for a decade. And I keep saying, if it wasn't for Ballmer, there would be no Microsoft. Kudos to Ballmer and everything that you're doing. I think you're amazing. But he wasn't right for that CEO position. And Gates had a lot to do with that with the infighter. But I think this is probably, and I still love Apple. For everyone who's messaging me like, should I sell Apple? No. But I think we are seeing a passing of the guard, if you will. And most importantly, we need publicly traded companies to build things that actually work and that people need. We don't, and I have three of them. We don't need another iPhone 7 upgrade that's called a 15. Microsoft has actually innovated. And then once they got into the AI space, amazing partnership with like that joint venture that they did with OpenAI, it put them in a different category. So if I was Apple, I would be a little bit worried. And Microsoft, as of now, definitely is a better company.
A lot there. There's a lot there. Interesting. I mean, it was short-lived. Right. So Apple did go back on top as the number one as far as market cap. But I'm with you in 2024. I definitely, and we said this 6 months ago when we were looking at the market caps, we were analyzing and saying based on the forward momentum that Microsoft has, especially with the partnership, like you said, in OpenAI, there's a chance here that they're going to pass them and that day came. And I think it's going to be prolonged for a couple of reasons. But I think that AI space is one of them. You mentioned that there hasn't been a product that Microsoft has had, a consumer product. And so I had to, when you said it, I started thinking like, was there a product? Is Windows the last product? Right. Is that the last thing that people could say that we really loved?
In the 90s.
That's in the 90s. Right. And interestingly enough, what they've now done with OpenAI and creating Copilot, this might be the thing. So if you look at the numbers on Copilot, I just did a quick research on it. Nearly half of Fortune 100 companies have incorporated into the enterprise software already. And so you're talking about large revenue, right? When you're talking about Fortune 100 companies, but they're going to have it for consumers as part of their office package in this year. What that does now, when you have OpenAI, right? And you have Copilot using that, now you need more cloud space. And so what has been increasing over the past three quarters for them? Azure, right? And it's kind of dented in a space where Amazon, AWS is by far the leader. It's cracked a dent in their lead. It's cracked a dent in Google Cloud's lead. And now Azure is that third place player with a lot of momentum. And so if you're looking at these two things alone, and last week we talked about it, what's the innovation? What is the thing that Apple will have? And we don't know it yet.
Yeah.
No, the fact that they are already in the lead in this AI space with these mountain factors, I like them for 2024 and maybe for 2025 if we don't see the exact innovation. I know people in the comments, I actually read the comments the other day when we did Market Mondays, and they're like, yeah, people said the same things when Steve Jobs passed. They don't innovate enough. They don't innovate enough. Okay. They had products. They have had products.
But that wasn't true.
Well, this is what the comments were saying, right? They've had products, and yes, right? We've seen what Tim Cook has done. And I mean, there's an argument that he could be when it goes down right in history and we look back, he might have been a greater CEO than Steve Jobs was.
Awesome. No question. That's right? No question. Yeah.
And so now is the time, right? Over the next 12 to 16 months, it's going to be an important time. And I know it's like, it's semantics, right? Your market cap is number one, ours is number two, but it means something, right? And those headquarters, right? It means something. And Amazon's right there too, right? In the past, I think 12 years, there's only been three companies that have been in that one and two spot, Amazon, Apple, yeah, and Microsoft. So it definitely means something amongst them. And whoever comes out with the most innovative and is leading in a way of the future, especially for technology, I mean, they get the crown. And I'm sure that people in Apple think about it the same way that Amazon and Microsoft do. Everybody wants to be the top spot.
Yeah. If the enterprise value or the market cap value is the same, Apple's profit margin is 25%. Microsoft is 34. For a multi-trillion dollar company, that's like a $100 million business having an 80% profit margin. It does matter. And if they make another acquisition, being Microsoft, that could give them a further lead. It's never a good thing when you have a brand and people are, before it comes out, are saying, I'm not going to buy that product. Even yeah. Apple fans are saying, unless it can shoot out laser beams or transport me to Davos or put me in Game of Thrones, I'm not even going to consider it.
Listen, we're here, right? We walked the streets for 2 hours. Every 10 feet, two letters are posted all throughout the streets, and it's AI everywhere. AI, yep. It's AI, it's AI. And if we think about AI, especially from the consumer side, who's leading that space? There's no doubt it's Microsoft. Yep. It's no doubt. Not even a question. So.
But continue to Tech 2 Index, no stress. I even remember people saying Microsoft wouldn't have that number one spot. Invest in those two, you'll be good. But I still want the companies that I'm invested in to keep their edge and keep innovating.
So let's talk about football, shall we?
Yes.
Because this is...
How about them Cowboys?
I'm sorry. But at what point were Cowboys fans stop expecting greatness?
Man, that was tough.
If every week your girl go to the club and cheat on you and come home and say, baby, I'm sorry, on Monday, at what point, like, Dallas Cowboy fans like abuse?
That was rough. That was rough. But at least we got to watch it.
True.
Yeah. Well, brighter days are ahead. But from a business,
if they get Belichick.
Bill Belichick, the best to ever do this.
Perhaps. Perhaps again, not that he's the best. He's the best.
He's one of the people that I relate to. Him.
I saw you post that. In what way?
In every way. You know, as far as him just always maintaining that demeanor forever, right? Yeah. You never seen him get too high. You never seen him get too low. Consistent champion. Just his work ethic is unbelievable. But I really relate to the demeanor. I just feel like, you know, he's a very misunderstood person. And I feel like if you're a champion, sometimes you're going to be a different person. Like Tiger Woods, not a normal person. Like Steve Jobs, not a normal person. Bill Belichick, not a normal person. Michael Jordan's not a normal person. Very few people are like LeBron. Well, LeBron's like a good guy. You know what I'm saying? Like he's the person that, you know, is a very friendly person, and his personality is exuberant. He breaks the mold. But yeah. A lot of these champions, Nick Saban, same way.
Yep.
you got to win, man. You got to win. So I just really respect Belichick because he's just, he did it. He did it at the highest level. Six championships. You can't argue. Now I'm going to say Tom Brady. Of course, you got the best quarterback.
He made a vital mistake.
Look, at the end of the day.
What was the vital mistake, though? We got to talk.
He made a vital mistake.
It's not over yet. His legacy is not over yet. And even if it is over, he won six championships.
If he go win in Dallas, he's the greatest coach of all time in any sport. If he goes there and wins,
He might be that now. I'm just saying he made a vital mistake that is going to be part of his life.
Well, everybody's going to make a mistake. Everybody's going to make a mistake.
A vital. Yeah, I made square. Shit. That was 2 years ago, by the way. I'll send you a little review. 2 years ago.
they made a review video?
Yeah, always.
Damn.
Hit that demonetize button on you real quick.
they'll play. That's fast.
Yeah, but Billy Belly, hold your head, man. You know, it was a hell of a run. So we'll see where he ends up. But for this conversation, we're gonna talk about business and streaming. So big game. You know, I'm a Kansas City Chiefs fan.
I want somebody to please write this down.
I've been a Kansas City Chiefs fan since I was a kid.
He's been saying this since the show started. I will give him that.
No, he's been saying this since Patrick Mahomes been winning Super Bowls.
All right, we can ask my mom. I've been a Kansas City Chiefs fan.
Everybody knows if they winning, he's riding with them.
Kansas City Chiefs. I've been, you know, Arrowhead, salute that. You know, Christian Okoye.
Right. Who's the quarterback before Patrick Mahomes?
I was a Kansas City Chiefs fan when they had Derek. Christian Okoye.
That was 92.
The Nigerian Nightmare.
Who was the quarterback before Patrick Mahomes?
The Nigerian Nightmare.
They're going to put it in the chat for you.
Listen, man.
Real fans would know that.
Listen, man. So, and I remember Montana. When Montana came
over. That's 93.
Exactly. That's the era that I'm from. The mid-90s. That's
30 years ago.
Exactly. That shows my loyalty. Right. It's nothing new.
So, in between
that. Exactly. That's exactly my point.
Did you watch
in between? No, I'm not a diehard football fan. So, I'm not catching up with, you know, every little, who's the cornerback from the Detroit Lions in 1997 when he broke his ankle and Barry Sanders read it back in the freezing snow.
the theatrics are good.
I'm not a diehard football fan.
That the theatrics are good, but you should know the cornerback that was there right before.
Look, man, we support the winning teams, man.
And,
Pat Mahomes, one of them ones.
There you go.
He's one of them.
I respect that.
You was swag surfing when Taylor was doing a swag.
Yo,
they said
he was going crazy though.
Snow. They made up a couple.
They said snowboarding.
Shout out to Taylor.
That's funny. We're making sure she's gonna be at that.
We can't qualify or quantify as a swag surf. But I mean, they were enjoying themselves. I'm not mad at anybody that's enjoying themselves. Shout out to the snowboarders.
So let's talk about this, shall we? Okay. The NFL paid $110 million to Peacock.
Yeah.
For Kansas City versus Miami game, and that was for one-off. That was a one-off game,
crazy.
Right? So now it's like, okay, well, will companies replace cable for streaming and make revenue on forced sports subscription? Because most sports, basketball, baseball, football, they're all on cable television, mm-hmm. ABC, yep. NBC, Fox, or their satellites like ESPN and stuff like that, mm-hmm. Which most people – the ABCs and all that is free, and ESPN is part of most people's packages.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these, like NBC owns Peacock, right? So now all these big companies are having their streaming arms. So, all right, it's a streaming war.
Yeah.
So an easy way to try to increase revenue and get more people signed up for your streaming is to switch your sports programming from free to paid streaming mm-hmm. model, right? They already kind of do this with the Thursday night football.
Yep.
But it's still like, so what if, you know, Monday night football, what if the Super Bowl was on pay-per-view? How would that change the landscape as far as revenue models, subscription based? So this is something that a lot of people was mad about because they didn't want to pay to watch the game. We still have to see the numbers. I'd be interested to see the numbers and what they looked like.
Mm-hmm.
But is this a way that streaming can take off? And what's your thoughts before we bring our esteemed guest on? I see he just checked in the building.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. We were at the airport sitting and kind of like breaking that down. And it was, I'm thinking to myself, if the NFL is a business, first and foremost, and if the goal of your business is to make money.
Too.
right? And if the goal of the business is to make money, and if Roger Goodell is the head of the company and his job is to make money, I'm going to try to find different ways to generate revenue, right? The model of cable television is broken. We've seen that. When we saw Thursday Night Football, when its original inception was just on NBC, right? And then they decided, you know what? We have our own cable network. Why put it on NBC when we can have subscribers come to our network? Smart. And then people didn't really do that, right? And so they started doing Amazon Prime, right? You could watch Thursday night games, and then great partnership. But then Major League Baseball did that. Even if, like, I'll try to find a Yankee game and it'll be on Amazon Prime. I'm like, okay, well, they're starting to sell these games or these packages for the season. The $110 million for a playoff game, because it's like NFL fans are a different level. Like, fanatic is I think an understatement for the way that Americans view football. So to have the most popular player in the game, Patrick Mahomes, arguably maybe one of the most popular teams outside maybe the Cowboys, to have Miami Dolphins, to have that game and to say this is the price point, I think it sets a new precedent for it. Like you said,
when you got the swag surf
and then, you know, right, people are already watching for you know, the theatrics of Taylor Swift being there. But even if you look at the last year's Super Bowl, it was the most watched Super Bowl in the history of the NFL, and Patrick Mahomes is part of that too. And so you're gonna optimize the opportunities that you can sell your number one player, right, to your public. Was it fair to the fans? That's a different argument. From a business standpoint, I think it was a great deal. $110 million for one game, right? Yeah. You could do that for the AFC Championship, right? If he's in there again. What's the price point on that? Like you said, where does it stop? Is the Super Bowl now something that can become pay-per-view? I think it sets a precedent for business and sports media that I don't know how you come back from, right? I think that the broadcasting of it might change over the next 5 to 10 years. I mean, it'll have to if Disney decides, hey, we're going to put this on Disney Plus because ESPN is under that package, and Amazon says, hey, we're going to get, you know, Monday Night Football, and now the playoff games are all on Peacock or something, or Paramount, I think CBS is under. So this is like the new streaming wars inside of sports, because the NFL is the first thing, but the NBA will be next. Their contracts will be up. Major League Baseball, Apple, we always talked about what sports league will they get to now stream on their platform. So
yeah,
this is something that we definitely got to pay attention to as fans and as people that are watching business moves.
In a world of dying media, the NFL, we don't talk enough about how great of a job they've done at branding over these last 30 or 40 years. But Goodell does a lot that I don't like. But in terms of running the business, he's done a fantastic job. And while media is dying, it's the only linear show that people still tune into live and are excited to check out. And that fan base continues to grow. I think they've done an amazing job there. I am interested to see what the numbers are. But if you're selling a show for $110 and you have $500 million in advertising or $300 million, it's definitely going to bring in a different model. And we're seeing it with Pat McAfee, like sports is the hottest thing going. So I think they're doing a great job of leveraging that asset in a time when every other media company is having issues right now.
Yeah, if you look at the Nielsen ratings, is like what people are watching in American homes. The number, I think that out of the top 20, I think 15 of them are Monday Night Football.
That's insane.
The most watched things on American TV is Monday Night Football.
That's so crazy.
It's insane.
Why did Netflix throw a bag to get that Thursday night game?
Yeah, it was so random. I didn't hear anything about this until the week of the game when people started complaining that they weren't going to be able to watch the game. I wonder if that was already structured before the season started, or this is something that they did pre-playoffs. That would be
probably have to be structured in beforehand. They just didn't announce it because for all that bandwidth and I'm sure they had to have structured it in and do a quick rollout in terms of the announcement. But I think it was brilliant. It's not the best thing for the fans, but I mean, for a premium game like that, it is worth paying, and it's much cheaper than flying there and buying a ticket.
This is true.
Yeah. And shout out to the Texans who won this past week two. First time in 25 years or however many. Shout out to Bun. Slim was out there. My guy Tavares was out there. So
they just announced the tour. You saw that?
Yeah, yeah, crazy.
Still tipping to it. Mike,
go get the bag. That bag. It'll make sense to beef. There's more money in collaboration. Keep telling y'all.
Texans are tough, man. CJ Stroud, tough.
Yeah.
Tough. All right. So let's bring our guest on. JC.
What's up, John?
Let me just clap it up for you one time.
Yes. My brother, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you, guys. Thanks for
thank
the
you for being here. How you feeling, man?
Listen, it's the world can be a messy place, but when you take a step back and you zoom out and you appreciate, you know, all of the progress that, you know, is made slowly, might not be on the front page of the news, but it's small little wins for society that, you know, kind of go unnoticed. But you know who is noticing is investors. S&P, mm-hmm. NASDAQ, Dow, new all-time highs. Europe, new all-time highs.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? So, and pessimism still rules. You know, you look at consumer sentiment and, you know, we're at some of the most pessimistic levels of all time. Yeah. Stock markets at all-time highs. Sell-side strategists, Wall Street, super bearish, super pessimistic. That's a great combination of people being worried that things are bad, but then things are actually, they've never been better. That's a great combination. It's when everybody thinks that everything's so great, that's when the problems start. But we're just not there. I mean, you guys tell me if I'm wrong.
Well, yeah. So I wanted to, well, first and foremost, thank you for coming back. Appreciate it. JC, yay, we did a marvelous job last time he was here. So I want to start out with, I know you're a charts guy. So based on the charts that you're reading, now you look at things, how do you see 2024 playing out? You know, a lot of people said, you know, obviously we had a great year in 2023. There's some people that's nervous. The political cycle, it would say that it would be a good year based off of past history, based on an election year. So where do you see this market right now as far as charts is concerned?
I like how you throw out the seasonality there. No big deal. It's a little 4-year cycle. Throw out, shout out there. I like it. No, listen, it's less about the charts and more about reality, right? A lot of people are like, oh, the market should do this, or oh, the market could do this. What is it actually doing, right? That's what I'm mostly interested in. What is actually happening? And it just so happens that the best way to visualize what's actually taking place in the market is in a chart, right? You could literally see it. And like, I'm not like the smartest guy. Like, you could tell me something a million times. You got to show me. Like, let me see. Like, can I just see? So the charts are very helpful to be able to see what the market is actually doing. Is the world falling apart? I don't know. Let's see what the S&P 500 is doing. Oh, I see it at all-time highs. So I don't know. Maybe the world is not actually falling apart. Maybe things are pretty good. Oh, maybe it's just the United States that's doing so well. Why don't we look and see what's going on in other countries? Oh, shit. Brazil's making new all-time highs. So
yeah.
Chile and Peru. And
the Nikkei.
Nikkei 33-year highs. Germany new all-time highs. All Denmark does is go straight up with their healthcare. It's fantastic. France, new all-time highs, ton of industrials there. You look at Asia, things like Jakarta, right? Like, the only thing not working is China, right? Which is a very rare exception. I mean, you go down to Australia, things are good. So just more new all-time highs across the board. You see an expansion of stocks making new highs, right? We had over 50% of the S&P 500 was hitting new 3-month highs the other day. Like, those are the types of things that happen early in cycles. So in terms of like, what are the charts telling me like for the year? Well, I don't know what's going to happen a year from now, but we're not in a market environment where things are getting worse. For the last 18 months, we've been in a market environment where things keep getting better. So you're going to see things stop getting better before they start to get worse, right? Like, we're not getting, you know what I'm saying? Like, things aren't getting worse. They just keep getting better. So like, when that stops, then we'll, you know, we'll have a different conversation. So that's how I see it. You know, so what does that mean? Oh, it's a bull market. It's a bear market. Like, why should we care what kind of market environment we're in? Because that's the first thing that we want to do as investors. First, identify what type of market environment we're in, and then decide the best tools and strategies for that environment. Right. So if we're in a low volatility environment, why on earth would you incorporate strategies that are good for high volatility environments? That would be stupid. Right. That would be dumb. That just doesn't make mathematical sense. So we're in a low volatility environment. Let's incorporate strategies that are good for low vol environments. OK, are the majority of stocks going up or the majority of stocks going down? I don't know if you've looked, but the majority of stocks have been going up. So we want to spend our time. Yeah, we want to spend our time looking for stocks to buy versus allocating more time looking for stocks to sell. You know, there are more uptrends than there are range bound markets. So we don't necessarily want to incorporate too many range bound market strategies. We want to incorporate more trend following strategies, right? So that's how we look at the current state of the market, how we want to approach it. I think it's like that.
When we look at 2024, we've already heard that there was going to be rate cuts. And so we're big on technology. We talk about technology companies all the time. We see companies going up and up. With the rates getting lower, obviously that would create an environment for tech companies to continue to appreciate. What are your thoughts on that? Because everybody keeps talking about this pullback, this recessionary environment in the second half of the year. They said that in 2023. We didn't see it. We spoke to you about it, and the charts didn't indicate that. What are your thoughts around the tech sector with interest rates being reduced over the next 6 months?
Yeah, you know, stocks and bonds are moving together. That's the big thing. And if you look at technology, technology represents almost 30%. Basically, today it's essentially pennies from 30% of the entire S&P 500. This is technology. So if we know that stocks and bonds are trading together, right, then your thesis that lower rates should be good for technology stocks, I would agree with all of that, right? That would make perfect sense. You know, what I think actually is getting, you know, taking that one step further, what I think part of the driver of that trend that you're talking about is the fact that a lot of investors still think that the treasury bond market is the safe haven. Like when stocks sell off, bonds rally, that inverse correlation that we had in place for a long, long time, the majority of my career, certainly. But we're not in that type of environment. We're in an environment that's more inflationary, where stocks and bonds are trading together. Something like maybe the 1970s. So we're just in a different kind of environment where stocks and bonds need to be treated differently than most of us have been accustomed to over the last 20 years. So that's just something to keep in mind. And I think it's taking investors a long time to come to terms with that. And I think that that is further unwind of just how critical I think, you know, rates staying down could be good for the stock market and technology in particular as 30% of the S&P.
What stocks or sectors surprised you the most in 2023 and how much they went up?
Well, I mean, I didn't see a 50 spot on the queues, I'll tell you that much. You know, I mean, you know, we were bullish, we were buying stocks, we were buying them, you know, because if you recall, kind of like rewind for just a second. So back in the late 22, the short interest in these tech stocks was off the charts, right?
Yeah, it was high.
We had a bear market. The majority of stocks bottomed out in June of 2022, right? That's when most stocks stopped going down. And then from there, things got better. But some of the tech stocks and Qs continued to fall, even though most things were already on their way up in the back half of 22. The bears, the short sellers, instead of covering their shorts after these massive declines, like 80, 90% decline in some of these growth stocks, right? You guys know.
Yeah.
Rather than covering their shorts, some did. We were short some stocks. We covered our shorts, right? Some people did. But in aggregate, which is what counts, not only did they not cover their shorts, they added to their shorts so that by the end of 22, they were the most short those growth stocks the entire cycle after most stocks had already bottomed. So that's that unwind. And then Wall Street comes in with their first negative expectations for the S&P 500 on a consensus basis, negative year, first time all century. Yeah. At the same time that all these institutions were super short, you got that nasty squeeze. So what surprised me? I didn't see, as bullish as we were, I didn't see a 50 spot on the queues. But what I will say that I'm not surprised, but I think is going unnoticed, is that the best performer in the second half of last year was financials. Mm. Nobody's talking about that. Remember banking crisis?
Yeah.
Three banks no one's ever heard of disappeared. So what? More of them should have gone. There's too many as it is.
How do you feel about the AI, potential AI bubble, and how that could affect the market?
You know, listen, man, this is way above my pay grade in terms of like AI. Like, obviously, I have some smart friends and I listen to smart people. I try to. And, you know, they have big expectations. I'm sure there is. For me, in terms of what I can do, what I can control, certainly not building AI algorithms or whatever. Like, I got my friends, they'll do that for me. And then I get to play with the toys they build. Great. And I'll invest in some of them too. That's great. I'm just not going to do it, right? For me, I'm more interested in like, okay, who's winning in all of this? And who's winning is really the biggest players, like Google, Microsoft, Nvidia. They're the ones that are winning. Like, from what I could see, the more like pure plays, AI plays, like most all that is bullshit. Like, to me, I think like just the companies with the best resources, the most money, the ones that have been way ahead of this before it got sexy, like, and they're the, and you look at the charts, because that's what's actually happening and they're winning. Now, are they winning because of AI or are they winning for a variety of reasons? Probably for a variety of reasons, but the AI probably isn't hurting.
That's are you surprised at how much the bond market has fallen? Really since what, 2020? I know you talked about it earlier, and I talk about this Rashad and Troy all the time. Like, I never thought I would see like a bond collapse like this. Are you surprised, or does this remind you a lot of the 70s, and do you think we'll be here for the next 3 or 4 years?
Man, let me tell you something. Nothing surprises me in the market anymore. You know, I'm too old. I've seen too much. I'm so numb. And I sometimes, people who maybe not have had those experiences, it might seem kind of like, oh, nothing surprises me. Oh, crude oil trading below zero? Yeah, sure. Why not? Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that was like, crazy. Like, good negative barrel.
Like, I used to work across the street from Bear Stearns headquarters, like overnight, gone. See ya. No big deal. Just another day. Yeah. You know, I mean, I've seen some shit, man. So like, am I surprised? No. I mean, I've been hearing about this bond sell-off my entire career, right? Like, okay, now there's your bond sell-off. I'm finally 20 years later, right? Like, yeah. I've been hearing about this forever, right? Because everybody wants to pick a bottom. Everybody wants to pick a top. You know, I could see a situation where we're kind of like in a messy range for a while and rates, you know, go up a little, down a little, but kind of stay within a range, not have this like secular turn where, you know, rates are going to go to 15% tomorrow. Could we get there eventually? Maybe, you know, but for the foreseeable future, I think it's probably going to be a little muted, probably just messy in general. What I will say is, also, the correlations with energy as well have shifted. It's almost like the 60-40 portfolio of stocks and bonds is now really 100 portfolio, because stocks and bonds are moving together. So there's no 60-40 or nothing. But on the other, but if you kind of like sort of navigate that 60-40 differently in this environment, it's more like a 60 stocks, 40 energy. More of a 60-40 that makes sense in this environment. How long that lasts? Who knows? But my suspicion is it's going to last a lot longer than people think.
So what do you mean 60-40 energy? What are you talking about?
Well,
energy stock?
Traditionally, stocks and bonds don't move together. They've been moving inversely for a long time, right? When stocks sell off, bonds rally, right? And you're still getting your yield if stocks are doing well. So it's kind of like a balance, if you will. But when stocks and bonds are moving together, there's no 60-40. It's 100, right?
No, for sure. I got that part. But you said energy. You said energy is a new bond.
So now you're seeing a negative correlation between the rest of stocks and energy, right? So when stocks are under pressure, you're going to get relative strength out of energy, we've noticed. Right? Yeah. And when stocks are doing well, tech stocks, all these things are doing well, energy is not doing well. So energy is now moving with rates, right? So as rates are coming off, energy is underperforming. As rates are going up, stocks are under pressure. Energy is doing well in that environment. That's what we've seen. So if you're going to do a 60-40, that would make more sense than a stocks and bonds when stocks and bonds are just moving together. So it's really just 100.
Got you. Would that put pressure on a company like Tesla being in the EV space if Chevron, Exxon are going up when our market is selling off?
Yeah, like indirectly. Like if the market is selling off, then Tesla's probably going to be under pressure, and a company like Chevron and Exxon can actually do well in that environment. Yeah, I don't think I think it's more of just a coincidence. I don't think one is navigating, like one tail is wagging the other dog. You know what I mean? Like, I think that there it's just a sort of the way the market mechanics work. But Tesla's like in a messy range. It's been in a messy range for a few years. There's Listen, well-deserved, too. That was a huge move. That was like a legendary move in market capitalization that we've rarely, you can argue, maybe never seen
never,
that much market cap grown that fast. You may, I mean, we have to go back and do the math, but regardless of whether it's happened or not, it's not something you see very often. So yeah, let it take a break. Let it chill out. Well deserved, you know?
Time for a breather.
Yeah,
well, I don't want to go.
By the way, it's been breathing for 3 years. So, I mean, it's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting point, right? Because what people will look at NVIDIA, they'll look at Microsoft, and they'll say, well, new all-time high. Should we get invested? Obviously, we never suggest people invest when it's at its peak. But are there specific indicators that you're using to say, all right, this is now a time that we should be getting into these companies? Because we, like we said, we know that technology has run up over the past 5 years for sure. NVIDIA, we saw, had an incredible year last year. Everybody's predicted that it's, you know, the price point is at an average of $600. So there's still room for growth. Are there indicators that you're using or that you would recommend for somebody that's beginning to look at charts that could help them in that journey to say, all right, this is the time to invest?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, if there's any indicator, it's going to be price, because price is the only truth. Price is never going to be restated. Like, it's a fact. Like, there was a buyer and a seller at this price at this given time, and that's never going to change. Now, the seller might not have wanted to sell, and it was the margin clerk selling it for him, and maybe the buyer didn't get the best price or whatever, but that's the price that it paid, and that's never going to change. And one thing we know for a fact, is that asset prices trend. We know that. They go up, they go down, they go sideways. They trend. We know that. And we have the math, right? And if you're into white papers, knock yourself out. They're all over the place. But if we know that, and we know asset prices trend, then as investors, shouldn't we be spending a lot of time looking for trends and finding trends in asset prices? So, you know, we look for trends in the stock market. Are we seeing more stocks making new highs, or are we seeing fewer stocks making new highs? So it's about recognizing trend on a micro level, a specific stock like NVIDIA, or analyzing the trend of the overall market, which is a composition of 500 trends or a 1500 trends or 2000 trends in the Russell 2000, right? And, you know, taking a weight of the evidence to get the direction of the overall tide correctly and try to have the wind at your back. So in other words, if most stocks are going up and the trend for most stocks is up, then you're going to probably have more success in buying a stock that's going up and being part of that group. Now, if the majority of stocks are falling and we're in a bear market and you're going to try to be buying stocks in that environment, you're swimming against the tide. Like, you have, the odds are not in your favor, right? And if you're buying a stock that's going down in an environment where most stocks are going down, then good luck, you know, like, that's not going to end well, right? So you really want to be in the direction of the trend, you know, and then look for, you know, and this comes over time, is understanding what these changes in trends look like and the process of those changes. And you start to sort of develop your own process over time. But at the very least, someone who's never looked at a chart, like, do yourself a favor and look at a chart and zoom out. Right? You look longer term. And that's the beauty of technical analysis, is the ability to use multiple timeframes. We want to start with a longer term, understand the longer term trends. You know, we're talking about interest rates, right?
Yeah.
Interest rates were going down for 40 years, and now we're seeing something different, right? Things are starting to change, but these were long trends that persisted for a long time. You know, you look at the Russell 2000, small caps, people are so like, short term, it's messy, it's in this range, oh my god, da, 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 it's not making all-time highs, the market's gonna crash. Do yourself a favor, take a deep breath, zoom out, and you'll notice that same Russell 2000 stock has been making higher lows and higher highs for decades. It goes up over, you know, it's been going up over time. You know, I think that this one, it continues higher from here, but you're not gonna see that if you're so zoomed in, you know, like a racehorse where you got these blinders on. Like, open it up and zoom out. Whenever in doubt, zoom out. And it'll really help give you perspective. And then you can identify the shorter term trends for your specific time horizon, but doing so within the context of the bigger trends.
What time frames are you using to differentiate between like a short term fluctuation and a like long term mega trend?
Yeah, no, and this is a great question, because everyone's going to give you a different answer, right? I've been doing this for a long time. I've heard a million answers, right? So it's going to be a very personal answer. Like, what do you consider short-term? What do you consider long-term? For me, you know, I look at assets going back, you know, 50, 75 years, you know, in some cases, like interest rates and certain indexes where I have that data, and it, you know, precious metals and oil. Like, there's certain data that goes back that far. There's a lot of data where that's not really necessary. So I do that kind of just to get perspective and, like, you know, analyze, you know, former bull markets and bear markets and things like that in the past. But, you know, realistically, over the last 25, 30 years, gives you a nice zoomed out look at overall trends in Europe and Asia throughout sectors, you know, stocks, all of those things. And then I'll break it down for, you know, charts that go back maybe nine to, you know, 15 months or so. And then from there, then I'll look more short term at, you know, the last couple of months for, you know, entry points and things of that nature. And then I'll look at the implied volatility to analyze to see whether that particular stock or ETF that I'm looking to participate in is in a low volatility regime or a relatively higher volatility regime, so that I know what strategy to then implement, right? If I'm going to be in the options market or if I'm going to be in the common stock. In some cases, the options market just doesn't give us the opportunity that we're looking for whatever reason. Yeah. And the common stock makes more sense. Or in another case, the options are so stupid, no brainer, that there's no reason to be in the common. You could be in the option, right? Anytime is different. And we could talk a little bit more about that if you're interested in, but it really becomes a case-by-case basis.
So let me ask you, what stocks, ETFs are you personally bullish on?
Am I personally bullish on stocks or ETFs? Listen, I like NVIDIA above 500. You know, for me, it's about finding risk versus reward opportunities that are skewed in my favor. Like, this is a very selfish endeavor is what this is. We are trying to make money, period. Nothing else matters. When you invest, that is the goal. So if the goal is to make money, and that is my only goal, then what I want to make sure that I'm doing is not losing money. Right? Warren Buffett, rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one, right? That's Warren Buffett, somebody who's made a lot of money, by the way. So don't lose money. So we always want to enter a position and know where we're wrong, how much we could possibly lose in a worst case scenario, and be okay with that. Because that really goes a long way, number one, in keeping your money. But number two, mentally, like, it takes away so much mental stress knowing you have a plan. You fully anticipate and just sticking to that plan, no big deal, just another trade, move on to the next one. Like, people get so emotionally attached. Oh, I'm never going to sell my Amazon. It's not your Amazon, first of all. Just because you own it, maybe you made some money, it's not your Amazon, right? You could press a button and it ain't yours no more, right? And, you know, it's not yours. People, like, have this emotional attachment to a stock, especially if it made a money once, right?
Yeah.
God forbid. We're dating. We're not marrying anything, right? And the minute they start pissing us off, I'm out. See ya, right? Bye, Felicia, right? No emotional attachment whatsoever. So I like NVIDIA above 500. And by the way, if NVIDIA is below 500, I don't want anything to do with NVIDIA. Not my problem anymore. Now it's somebody else's problem. Literally. Goodbye. If it's below 500. Above 500, I like it. I like the relative strength. I like the fact that it's consolidated for 5 months before recently now just breaking out. It's the strong group. Just generally speaking, semiconductors are above their prior cycles highs, making new all-time highs. So it's a leading group. It's not like I'm trying to get cute buying, right? So I like NVIDIA as a trade for sure. 500 target up near 750. So that's like another 40% higher, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good and good risk reward. I mean, obviously, it's taken off a little bit. The bet was to buy it on a breakout above 500, so we're a little bit extended from there. But nevertheless, that's the direction that we're heading in. Take a look at some of these industrials. You know, you see the strength in some of these European countries. A lot of that is driven by industrials, things like France and Denmark. These are, like, you know, like, we have almost 30% technology in the S&P 500 over there. It's like 27% industrials, right? Just to show you, like, as important as technology is for us, industrials is to them. And you're seeing new all-time highs in those countries. And it's not coming from tech, right? Because they don't have any tech over there, right? So
when you were talking about the options market, I wonder, what are the differentiating factors that'll make you decide, yes, I'll go with the stock or whether I'll go with the option? You said volatility is the bid, the ask.
Of course.
And obviously the strike. Is there a percentage that will deter you from saying, all right, I'm going to go with the option on this? Like, what is that decision process for you?
Yeah. So let's just say we're bullish a stock, right? and volatility is high, right? So if volatility is high and we're bullish a stock, then we could buy the stock, right? But what if there is no well-defined risk in the common stock? It's kind of just in a range and there's no well-defined risk. How do we define our risk on the common stock? We really can't. So we have to go to the options market. So now in the options market, if volatility was low, we could just buy a call option, right? Go out as far as possible, just buy a cheap call, easy peasy, nothing because volatility is low. But let's say in this example, volatility is high. So now we can do a few things. We could buy a call and then help pay for that by selling a further out of the money call to pay for that call because it's expensive. It's a high volatility regime, right? Or if we're really bullish and we really want to be a little more risky, we can sell an out of the money put, right? And take that cash to pay for the out of the money call, right? So there's a variety of different things we can do in a higher volatility environment. Now, if we're doing a risk reversal like that and we're selling an out of the money put, if at any point the price of the stock breaks below and closes below our strike on the put, all bets are off, right? And that's the risk management on something like that. So every type of strategy, there's a reason why we do that one instead of another one. And there's always a different risk management procedure in place before we even enter the trade. Like, let's just say that we're selling a 21 put and the stock's at 23. If at any point the stock breaks below that $21, one time, that's it. Unwind the trade, all bets are off. And we know that going in. Like, and in a call option, for example, we know that we're limited partners. No matter what happens, we can't lose more than what we paid for that call option. That's it. No matter what happens, the world comes to an end, can't lose more than the 75 cents or whatever that we paid for those June calls. You know what I mean? Like, and we're cool with that. Let it go to zero. I'm good with that. But could go to 10, right?
in that scenario, what is your percentage target that you're looking for? Because I think that'll help the audience a lot.
Sure.
I like risk-reward scenarios of 1 to 5, 1 to 11. But for each of those staggered strategies, what is the risk profile that you're putting on for your targets?
Right. So it depends on the strategy, right? So in a lot of cases, we're not trying to capture much. We're just trying to capture the volatility because in a higher volatility regime, it pays to collect income, right? Because volatility is more expensive. So in that case, the risk versus reward is not going to be great, but the probabilities of success are going to be really, really high. So you're collecting income. The income is not going to change your life. It's not going to be a 30 to 1, you know, a 30 bagger. You know, it's not that at all. It's actually the exact opposite. It's a much higher probability of success trade, but you're limited in how much money you're going to make. You see what I'm saying? But that's the type of strategy that works really well in a high volatility regime, a high probability bet where you're just collecting cash, just making it rain, just selling calls and puts all day long, just keep going, right? So that's the strategy in a high volatility regime. Now, on the other hand, in a low volatility, you can go out and buy calls for nothing. And you can go out 6 months or 8 months or even longer in some markets. And you get huge, huge winners, huge winners. But these are two completely different types of strategies that are best fit for different environments. Now, if you're trying to get that 30 bagger, you know, call option going out a year in some stock in a high volatility regime, you're going to pay a fortune. Like, you're going to pay so much money. Like, good luck getting that money back, no matter how well the stock does, right? Because it's so expensive. So that just doesn't make any sense in that environment. You're better off just collecting the income, right? Sell calls, sell puts all day long. So in the case of, like, let's say we sell a strangle. So in a strangle, the stock is here, right? At the money. You're selling an out of the money call option. And you're selling an out of the money put option, right? You're selling the wings and you're collecting that income. Let's say we collect $3. Let's say it's $1.50 each one. Let's just say we're collecting $3. If at any point we can buy back that strangle for half of what we collected, we unwind the trade right away. So we collect $3. As soon as we can collect $1.50, unwinds the trade. In fact, we place resting orders as soon as we sell the strangle, we also put the resting orders to buy the strangle back at $1.50 in that case right away. So is that going to be a 30 bagger trade? No, at all. We're just betting that volatility is going to just keep eating at the people buying calls and puts that are just churning their accounts, right? Because they can't help themselves but buy calls and puts. We'll just accept their donations.
So can you explain that a little bit? Can you explain that a little bit more? Because a lot of people might be new to the
But it's a hell of a gym. Yeah.
All right, so
sometimes you're betting that the stock doesn't go up or down. It just kind of
So I'm gonna kind of give some framework, and then you can kind of just fill in the blank. So when you say like out of the money call, so like let's say Apple is at 185 right now, so that would be let's say like a 220 call on Apple, right, for 2025 or something like that, right? Where it's out of the money, not in the money. Where in the money would be like 288, 285, like where it's at right now, right? So you're buying a 220 call on Apple for 18 months down the road. Let's just hypothetically use this as an example, right? So when you say you're selling, can you just kind of like elementary level explain that, what that is?
Beginner.
So these options, right, they have an element of intrinsic value, which is when you're in the money, and you have an element of time value, right? So if a stock is a 200 and these 250 calls, let's just say $50 out of the money, they don't have any intrinsic value. It's only time value. Right. That's the only thing you're paying for is time, because it's not in the money. Something that might be $10 in the money, you're paying for that $10 of intrinsic value, and the rest is time. Right. Now, as the expiration, right, June expiration, July expiration, whatever, as the expiration gets closer, the rate of deterioration of that time value increases. Right. So once you get to that 45 to 60 days until expiration, these are calendar days. You know, 6 to 8 weeks to expiration, that's when it really starts deteriorating very quickly. So if you're an options, if you're long options, you own those options, that's the period where you're going to be losing the most time value the quickest. So if you're on the other side of that trade and you are taking advantage of other people's premiums deteriorating, that's income for us. So if we're looking for that 45 to 60 day out sweet spot, when we're selling those options, right? So that's how we decide the expiration for those particular strategies. As far as the strike prices, you know, we'll look for a range bound, it'll be a range bound market where there'll be resistance above and support below, and the price is kind of somewhere in the middle. So essentially the bet is that the price of the stock or ETF remains in that range. It's not an uptrend or a downtrend. It's just a mess, and it's gonna stay a mess. And people are going to bet that it's going to be, you know, other people are betting that it'll trend. We're betting that it'll stay not trending, right? Essentially is the bet there. So we'll sell a call option on the upper end of that range, and we'll sell that strike. And then we'll sell the put option of the bottom end of that range, and we'll sell that put.
Is there a technique or strategy that you prefer over the other? Is it the time decay, or is it the intrinsic value? Meaning, like, are you doing short term, or do you prefer leaps? Meaning, they go 6 months to 2 years out. Is there one that you're selling? If you're buying,
right? So if I'm selling, we want to stick to that 45 to 60 day period, because that's when the premium really deteriorates, and we want to collect that cash. If I'm buying, I'll go out as far as possible. Like, it depends. Like, I remember a couple of years ago, we bought Chevron calls 2 years out for like nothing. It was a joke. It was like $2 for like 2 years, like 10, 15 bucks out of the money. It was like a joke. So what we do is whenever we buy calls like that, whenever it doubles, we're actually doing less of that these days because we want to be greedy. That's like our new strategy, is be greedier. But that's a whole nother thing. Historically, what we do, and we did with Chevron, is that as soon as the call option doubles, we sell half, right? And then we keep the rest as long as we want. We collected our money back, and now it's just house money. Part of our strategy this year is to not do that and be more disciplined with maybe raising stops, so that we can still capture without necessarily, you know, so we've been toying with that internally. So as you could see, it's a good example, like no matter how long you do this, you're always tweaking, you're always adjusting and doing new things. And I roll my eyes because we're being greedier. Like, you know, as a team, we're like making this conscious decision. You know, it's just funny.
And in terms of contract size, how many contracts are you using for these strategies? And are you doing a similar strategy with futures? So would you like go long two ES mini contracts and short two NASDAQ, or do you not touch the futures at all?
I personally don't trade the futures. I have managers that manage futures for me. I trade stocks, cryptos, and options myself.
Okay.
And I have other portfolios that trade options also for me and run a strangle selling strategy. So I don't trade futures personally. And then I have guys that trade different things, right? Throughout different investments and different investments. So that's how I sort of stay diversified so that the money that I am actually managing, like an individual account or a couple of different individual accounts, I can be more aggressive and more concentrated in those positions because I have other diversification and other strategies that are doing different things. Because something I learned over the years is that the answer to your question is how many contracts, not on the future side, but on the option side, depends on the premium, right? Could be one or two, could be 10 or 20, could be 50, could be, you know, thousands, technically. You know, I had 2,000 contracts of these out of the money Mara calls. You know, I was like all the open interest myself at some point. I know. But anyway, it depends on the situation. I didn't hold them long enough, for the record, story there. But nevertheless, at one point I did have I had 2,000 January 30 calls for Mara at one point. Anyway, so it just depends on the situation. But getting back to the diversification, you know, your real wealth diversification, in my opinion, by not just my work, my observations, but certainly work done by very smart people, but my observations as well, is having different strategies that are as uncorrelated with one another as possible. 3, 4, 5, you know, that 4 to 5 range mathematically seems to be like the sweet spot. Once you start getting more strategies than that, starts getting, you know, it's the law of diminishing returns or whatever. It's like being a basketball player, like, you know, maybe being 8 feet tall, it might have its advantages, but that's not really the ideal sweet spot, you know, maybe like a 6'9" with handles and can shoot from the out, you know, whatever, right? You know, like there's kind of like a sweet spot where you want to be, you know, so that's kind of how I think about it. So anyway, 4 to 5 strategies, I think, is, so that's how I think about it.
Well, JC,
can I get one more?
I want to say something. I want to make a correction. So I said 180. I said 285 is in the money. So I misspoke if I said that. Mike, let me know. I meant 185 for, I know some people in the comments might.
Journalistic integrity.
I like it. I like it. I like it. Listen, I say all kinds of stuff that I live. I'm like, did I really say that?
It happens. If you talk every day, it happens. Yeah,
it happens, man. It happens.
JC, I wonder, in the your options portfolio, is it diversified amongst a multitude of companies, or are there like 10 or 11 companies that you follow and trade? Right, because, you know, we've talked about this prior. There's been scenarios where we've had strategies where we have options on the companies, the stocks that we have already invested in. What's kind of your sweet spot?
Yeah, so we run a couple of different strategies. So for one of them, where we just sell strangles, what we do is we don't actually use any stocks at all. It's only ETFs. So we take the 35 most liquid ETFs, you know them all, you know, EEM, SPY, XLK, you know them all, or most of them anyway. So it's just those, because what that does, since we're selling strangles, we're selling naked calls and selling naked puts. So we're leaving ourselves exposed theoretically to, you know, major overnight gap risk that you'll get in stocks. That's relatively almost eliminated using ETF. So it's kind of like a risk management strategy in a strangle selling situation, where we don't have to worry about that. Right. So we just use the most liquid 35 ETFs. And what we'll do is we'll take the one with the highest implied volatility, the one paying the most, essentially, and sell that one. It's really that simple. And like you said, you know, and how we cover. So that's that strategy. And then in terms of the kind of like the more just buying and selling, you know, kind of adapting to the environment strategy, that is exactly what you said, about 10, 12 companies. Now, we don't focus on 10 or 12 companies that we specifically look to sell options. That's pretty much the basket of what the portfolio looks like. We are willing to trade any stock or ETF that is liquid enough to participate in. We don't care.
Okay. Final question for you. Can you walk us through your be greedy for 2024 strategy? I'm curious.
Well, so
what are the thesis behind it?
So, you know, every year we get together and it's like, what did we learn? You know, what mistakes did we make? And, you know, I guess a common theme that kept coming up was, you know, not, you know, letting our, we had some huge winners, And in some of those huge winners, we took some off the table too early. Our price targets were too conservative. And we just left money on the table that could have made a significant impact. So for example, traditionally we have always sold half of our calls as soon as the premium doubles. So if we pay $2 for the option and it's worth $4, we sell half and we let the rest run, and you know, we'll raise our stops along the way. Now we won't sell half. We'll just raise our stops. Okay. For example, that's one way that we are sort of adjusting. And sometimes it's going to shake us out, right? And we know that. And sometimes it's going to bite us in the ass because we could have taken money off. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
But we think that the longer term implications of letting some of those winners run will outweigh those little paper cuts we'll get.
On a year-over-year basis, how much more return do you think that would give you per year doing it that way?
Listen, it depends on the strategy, of course. In some strategies, there's no way to be greedier. They're just going to stay exactly the same. But in a situation like, you know, an options account, I mean, specifically in an options account, it can make a significant impact because some of these things can really, really appreciate. They could get, you know, these calls get in the money and the stock is running. I mean, I've witnessed huge moves in both directions, for the record, but, you know, huge, huge moves. So it can have a significant impact, like, I mean, thousands of percent appreciation in an account potentially is not out of the question at all. Right. I'm not saying that I'm promising 10,000% returns or something, you know, yeah, but I mean, that is the impact that you can potentially see in some of these positions, especially in some of those YOLO calls that we talked about before. If you're selling a strangle or you're selling, you know, putting together like a put spread or a call spread or something, you know, you're going to make a finite amount of money. It's a higher probability of success trade, but it's a finite amount of money. In the case where you can go out a year or two and buy cheap calls in something, 10, 15 points out of the money, and it gets 30, 40, 50 points in the money during that 2-year period, forget about it.
Yeah.
Right. But there's a time and a place. Those types of trades in a high volatility environment, you can't be doing that stuff. Right. You'll go broke right away.
Final question. Speaking of 10,000% return, what set of circumstances will we need to get to Kathy's proclamation of a 500,000 Bitcoin price or 1.5 for the bull case, you think?
As yeah, a I mean, listen,
chart technician.
I'll defer to her. I mean, she's smart. I'm sure she's done her homework to come up with that. Good for her. You know, let's get to 100 first, right? And then, you know, then we'll worry about it. And we have different time horizons, and her and I do different things. So, like, she's entitled to believe that. She could position accordingly. Her investors can follow her in that or not, right? Like, this is a free country. All of that is great. For me, that's great. She's obviously doing something, right? Good for her. For me, that is not what I do. Like, I do something else. Like, I'm interested in what's happening now. Like, our target was 47,000 on the Bitcoin. That was hit. We've seen rotation into Ethereum. You know, I think Ethereum goes to 3,800. You know, Bitcoin below 47 is kind of messy for a while. So I'm not really that interested in it. I'm interested in some of the other things. That doesn't mean I don't think Bitcoin goes higher. In fact, I do. I think we get back to 65 and rip through that and go to 100. Probably 120 is probably, you know, a good place to take a breather. I think that's how it plays out. But guess what? It doesn't matter what I think, right? We're stuck below 47. So I could tell you it's going to 120. I could tell you it's going to 10 million. It doesn't matter. We're still stuck below 47. So in the meantime, I'm kind of chilling out with Bitcoin. I'm looking at Ethereum and some of the others, you know, go down the list. Some of these other altcoins and stuff. Injective Protocol has been making a lot of new highs. TIA is another one. Some of these ICOs are coming out pretty heavy. So, you know, we've got our crypto scans that we've built over the years. I mean, we've been trading this stuff for a decade almost. Yeah, about a decade since 2014. Yeah. So,
yeah,
you know, quite some time. We started covering it you know, I wouldn't say I was trading it. I was holding some Bitcoin in 2014, but we really started covering it at our shop in 2016. So even then, you know, relatively early. So, you know, for us, we've come a long way, and we do a lot of like on-chain analytics as well, which I really, really like a lot. Like, because of the transparency of the blockchain, there's so much more data that we get in cryptos that we don't have in traditional assets like stocks and bonds and commodities. I would kill to have some of the data that we have in cryptocurrencies in traditional assets. I would kill for that data.
Well, JC, thank you for coming on.
Legendary. Thank you.
Appreciate your time. And feel free to come back anytime you want.
Yeah,
for sure, man. Thanks for the invite, guys. Appreciate it. You know, any questions, you guys know where to find me at All Star Charts. Come say what's up.
Yeah. Shout out to you, Mike Tyson, Mike Tyson punch out in the back.
You like that, right? You know,
absolutely.
Dude, I was giving a I moved into this office and years ago, and I was giving a presentation for some financial advisors, and you know how they are. Like, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the mouth. You know how these advisors are. So I was just going to, like, you know, make fun of them, and I had that. And they're like, yo, people like this. So I just left it up there. It's so funny. People, because you appreciate that because you played it as a kid, right? Yep. I mean, come on. What a great game.
Classic.
Classic. Classic. Yeah.
All right, I appreciate you, my brother. Thank you.
All right, guys. Have a good one. Adios.
All right. All right. Have a good one. And right. Masterful PR answer in response to Kathy. For all entrepreneurs.
She's brilliant.
Listen. Yes. Yes.
For sure.
Which is true. She is brilliant. And
she is.
That's why I said to say her analysis is misguided. It's tough because I know that the work that they do, I know, you know, we've met some of the people that work at ARK Invest, and we know the work that they put into it. And so
yeah,
I'm sure she has reasons to have such a prediction. So good luck to her.
Friend of the show. They hit that half a mil or that 1.5. Oh, baby. Yeah. Everyone put in chat, what was the biggest lesson you learned from JC? That's my guy, man. I think he dropped some gems with the options strategy and layering in those positions like that. Of course, we've talked about calls, and you guys have had some great calls, but I think the layering of those positions.
Yeah. Incredible. I mean, that was the strategy that I actually was doing last year. It was as soon as the call doubles, sell half and let the profits run.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it was, we talk about risk management. It's like, yes, the money that I invested, I took out, and I just let the rest run. So it was interesting that he said that, like, straight out. Yeah. That's exactly what I was doing.
And I think it's really important to have, like he said, a range bound, like, if the market really isn't moving a lot, whether it's options, futures, stock, a longer target, and then, like, a medium target, I think that's brilliant. But also, like, my mind started turning about going long ES, long NASDAQ, maybe short Russell 1000 or S&P 400 and timing it and layering it in a certain way. So your account's never down. And I think it was really fat. Like even what he talked about with energy, I said all the time, I never thought I'd see the bond market have this kind of issue. Rashad, I have the same kind of feeling you did. Like, damn, is energy the new bond market for the 60-40 portfolio? Like, imagine all the people who were in it the last 10 years and they're not doing so well in it. But I think it does go to show you always have to plan for what is the worst case scenario in every asset class, every market. So, yeah, great job. Great job, JC.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been real.
Yes.
It's been real.
You going to go see Robert Smith, or is that just at the event? You didn't announce that one.
We haven't run into Robert Smith yet.
Not yet.
But I'm sure we'll probably see him sometime.
We will see him. In February, we'll see him.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So,
see, Ellie.
Shout out to Carnegie Hall for having us back again for the second year. So get your tickets February 13th.
That's just that.
In Carnegie Hall, we will be speaking with Robert Smith. Rick Ross will be performing. The only black governor in America, Wes Moore.
Yes.
The governor of Maryland.
Yep, yep.
He will be speaking as well. So we did it last year with Paul Judge, Robert Smith, Busta Rhymes performed. So we coming back this year. Dope night. Carnegie Hall, very, very prestigious.
Twice.
Hall venue. Get your tuxedos and gowns ready.
and New York City. New York City. Get your tickets now. Go to Carnegie Hall website, their link in their bio, and get your tickets. That's something that's big, big for the city, big for just, you know, society, humanity.
Yeah.
And it will be a big night in New York. So
doing Carnegie Hall once is a life fulfilled dream for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So doing it twice, I mean, that's incredible. It's going to be a night to remember. Please, I know you said put the tux and gowns on, but let's show up the right way. Like, let's show up how we supposed to show up. Nice. Let's do it the right way, right? Yeah. The EYL way, the flyest way, showing what education could look like in the flyest level. So February 13th, make sure y'all pull up.
I would be remiss before you guys leave if I don't ask, what are some of the top lessons you've learned since you've been in Davos, Switzerland?
Well, we just got here. So next week will be a better.
Don't gatekeep, Rashad.
next week will be a better. We can recap fully next week because, we didn't really do anything yet. As we got our badges and we go into a party tonight. That'll be the kickoff situation. But after this week, next week we'll come on. And, you know, for me, this type of situation, it's like InvestFest. Like the two things I try to get out of these situations are to meet people. That's important. Yeah. And then also just to get information. So I'm trying to just sit in on as many panels and discussions as possible to learn what's happening, what's new, technology, AI, stuff like that. I'm definitely interested in going. I know ChatGPT has a panel tomorrow. Try to get to that.
Fire.
It's a lot going on. So next week we'll be able to speak fully on things that we learned, people that we met. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like I said, that's the two biggest things, I think, to meet people, network, and also to learn something.
To the reptilians, I got a new address. So if you need to send my little membership package, like I'll update my DocuSign. In other news real quick, Blackstone is defaulting on a bunch of commercial real estate.
Wow.
Could be spooky hours, but it would be an amazing opportunity for another company. And I'm hearing XRP may be making some moves in healthcare. And if they do that, they get banking and healthcare? With Larry Fink and Illuminati? Boy. It's gonna be good. Don't say. I know the Blackstone thing. Keep your eyes on. Keep your eye. And lastly, what do you think of Vanguard blocking their customers from buying Bitcoin ETFs?
I think it's probably because they set up their own ETF, right?
Yeah, they're waiting.
So they probably don't want, you know, all of their customers to spend all their Bitcoin money with somebody else
elsewhere. As opposed
to themselves. So I don't look too far into that. I just think that's just, you know, a business move as far as they want to keep money in-house, and they would, you know, discourage others until they have their own up and running.
Yeah, Pepsi isn't sending you to the Coke plant in Atlanta.
Exactly.
To go buy Coke Zero and Cherry Coke, but
not going to happen.
No. All right, it's been real. I'm taking your end.
All right, y'all be good to each other. Reach out. You know, spread some love, text somebody, you know, check on your people. Love is love. You know how we do. Safe travels to everybody that's traveling. And in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, let's try to commit service to our communities because they're desperately in need of it. So love is love. Peace.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.